You are listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you're hearing a conversation with M.T. Anderson, whose first graphic novel is now out, Evane, The Night of the Lion, published by Candlewick Press. M.T. Anderson is the author of Feed, winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, as well as The Astonishing Life of Octavia Nothing, Traitor to the Nation, Volume 1, The Pox Party, winner of the National Book Award and a New York Times bestseller, and its sequel, The Kingdom on the Waves, which was also a New York Times bestseller. Both volumes were also named Michael L. Prince Honor Books. M.T. Anderson lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts and Vermont. Eager for glory and heedless of others, Sir Evane sets out from King Arthur's court and defeats a local lord in battle, unknowingly intertwining his future with the lives of two compelling women, Lady Laudine, the beautiful widow of the fallen lord, and her sly maid, Lunette. In a stunning visual interpretation of a 12th century epic poem by Chrétien de Troyes, readers are at first glance transported into a classic Arthurian romance, complete with errant knights, plundering giants, and fire-breathing dragons. A closer look, however, reveals a world rich with unspoken emotion. Striking evocative art by Andrea Offerman sheds light upon the inner lives of medieval women and the consequences Evane's oblivious actions have upon Laudine and Lunette. Renowned author M.T. Anderson embraces a new form with a sophisticated graphic novel that challenges Evane's role as hero, delves into the honesty and anguish of love, and asks just how fundamentally the true self can really change. I began my interview with M.T. Anderson, who goes by Tobin, by asking him to talk about what inspired him to write Evane, The Night of the Lion. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The story is just that I really love medieval literature. I hate to admit that really the real reason is probably just that I was a D&D player when I was a teenager, and so I started to read literature of the Middle Ages back then, and I love the stuff with sort of the knights and the entanglements of honor and all that kind of thing. So anyway, this is a story by Chrétien de Troyes, who is a 12th century French author. And the amazing thing about it, actually, is that it has a certain irony around the way that gender plays out in the Middle Ages. And you don't usually see that, because usually in medieval literature, God bless them, the sense of women of any kind is very, very stunted. By and large, this is by men for courts of powerful men. And so, you have all these epics and things in which women are just ciphers. They are just the goal towards which you go. They are demure. They don't have speaking roles, all that kind of thing. So suddenly here you have this author who, typically is just sort of a man's man author, I think, early in his career. Suddenly he is actually at the court of this woman, Marie de Champagne, who's the daughter of Eleanor of Aquitaine, one of the most powerful women in European history. Right. And so suddenly he has a reason, in a sense, to write a different kind of story. And that's what fascinated me about this, was that here's a story of King Arthur and that kind of thing, but at the same time, along with all the usual beats of demons and dragons and that kind of thing, the central crux of it is really about love and murder, and the way that those play into a sense of like what it's like to be a woman in the Middle Ages, what it's like to be even a powerful woman in the Middle Ages. It's as if he's telling a different kind of story because he's telling it to a different set of people.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you have this silenced sector given a voice. And it really is a remarkable, remarkable text in the first place, And it's also funny because it's so critical of the sort of frat boy ethos of chivalry.
Yeah.
it reads at times, and I'm talking about the original. A lot of the dialogue in mine is actually just translated straight from the French.
Interesting.
Even if you read the original, for example, King Arthur comes off as kind of adult. And here you have one of the first Arthurian, full Arthurian poems. And yet, it's almost as if you discover that Monty Python in the Holy Grail was the text for Arthur instead of, you know, something sort of noble and pure. So it's, I thought that it was just a fascinating, fascinating text. I was like, this is definitely something I'd like to bring alive for an audience now that is not going to spend time reading an Arthurian epic.
Right. And I would think that as a graphic novel, you're also going to be reaching an audience that maybe needs to be thinking about women in a different way. I don't know if that's being sexist on my part, but I think that, you know, graphic novels are going to be read by a lot of young men who are in the point of trying to figure out what they think about the world. And I think it's a great story for them to be reading right now.
Well, and what I would say to that in particular is that there is, in fact, you know, I would put it in a historical context once again, that, I mean, if you look at the fantasy of my youth, by which I'm talking about the 80s, but with a lot of stuff taken from the 70s, like these artists like Boris Vallejo and that kind of thing, you know, it's a very titty kind of fantasy. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot, like breasts are part of the fantasy.
Yeah.
And which in a strange way suggests the fact that, you know, many of us who were fantasy aficionados, you know, we're never going to get near a breast. So so it was a fantasy. I mean, but, you know, I think that one of the things is that it's like I had always assumed that that had withered away. I mean, I am no longer a big consumer of fantasy or, you know, I occasionally read science fiction, but it's no longer my genre. You know what I mean? Like as an adult. But then exploding back onto the scene, in the last few years, I don't know if you followed it, but there have been all of these huge kind of kerfuffles about the way that men, young men, are getting sort of militant about the role of male and female in gaming worlds and in fantasy worlds of that kind. And you know, the so-called sad puppy kerfuffle in the science fiction world, that kind of thing. So you do have once again a situation where it's, you know, I mean, I think this is happening so much in various political arenas in this country right at this moment. You have people who, you know, for a couple of decades, we've assumed that we have achieved certain goals of sort of equality and that kind of thing. And something about the present time is pressing people so that they are actually revealing the fact that we really have not made as much progress as we thought.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to step back to something you said a minute ago. I wanted to just sort of read the opening lines from the book. It starts out, "I shall speak of love and hate. It is truly a marvel, but I tell you, hatred and love may live cramped together, crouching in the same heart." Are those his lines? Like, is that one of those moments that you just translated the opening?
Yeah, well, although oddly enough, it's that those are his lines, but they are actually from later in the thing. And I actually used them, therefore, sort of as a refrain a few times. But yeah, that is sort of his big set piece late in the book.
Okay.
And so, yeah.
I loved that as an opening, and it really caught me. Also, the falcon. It, there's this lovely image of a falcon being released.
There's an interesting story about that. Okay. So the idea was when we were trying to come up with an illustrator, I said, well, it's actually, well, at first, you know, we're just looking for people who could do sort of, you know, monsters, fantasy landscapes, and also, though, because there's so much interpersonal stuff, people who would also be able to do sort of expressive faces that are going to actually tell the human part of the story. You don't just want someone who can, you know, churn out battles, you know, and with, you know, airbrush painting.
Right.
So at first we found like a European illustrator who looked like he might work out, but you know, it was once again there was just a sense of sort of like the boobiness, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like we had a sense that he can really either do kind of sort of statuesque. Anyway, so we said, you know what we should do here? This is an opportunity to kind of enact the ironies and the silences in the text. Why don't we try to find a female illustrator specifically who then will provide a sort of a counterpoint in images to the words which are male.
Yes.
In the same way that the original author, he leaves certain silences. So, you know, for example, he at one point has a woman deliver a speech about how she hates someone, how she hates the man who's going to become her husband and will never love him. And then the very next line, he says, and so they, got married and lived happily ever after. So that kind of thing where he's clearly playing with a certain kind of irony.
Yes.
So we decided to do that. So, but that what that meant was that it also, I mean, it made sense. I had to cede some control to the illustrator, which is always going to happen. You know, you always cede control to the illustrator, and that's always a moment of liberation and also of anxiety.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, for example, the scenario I wrote for the very beginning of the book is not what appears. I had a much more straightforward, scenario worked out with the knight riding through the woods, having just been vanquished and sort of bleeding onto these flowers that were below him and that kind of thing. And
can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
When you wrote the original text, did you write ideas for illustrations as you went? Or do you
I did sometimes. I wrote a sort of like a Hollywood script it looked like.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Though sometimes, you know, much more vague. But if I had a specific idea, I'd definitely put it in.
Okay.
Just to give a sense of some of the possibilities that were there in the story. So anyway, the point is that the illustrator didn't like that idea, which is her prerogative. So she did a completely different thing, which is the falconry stuff, the stuff with this bird setting out. And at first, that image does not make sense to you. It doesn't make, you don't see what the context of that is until later in the story. But that actually was perfect because it also mirrored the fact that the lines that are being spoken at that point are from later in the story and don't entirely come into focus until the end.
Right. Yeah.
So it was a kind of a cool experience of watching the project transform in a way that I, of necessity, could not have predicted. And so that it did become that kind of interplay. I was like, well, look, I have to put my money where my mouth is. If this person says that she wants to take it a different direction than me, that's the way that we have to go. We're going to make it a combined product.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the other thing I'll mention is just having seen the falcon at the beginning, I thought that did a really good job of grounding us in time because I feel like at that time birds were used to send messages and that was sort of a very specific moment in time. And also it kind of embraces the whole idea of storytelling that there's this bird taking off and you just don't know what's going to – what is that? You know, and it just sort of
– Right, right.
It's like this 12th century hook. So
right, exactly, right, yeah.
All right, so you've already talked a little bit about your treatment of the women in this book as the author. And I just wanted to know, as you wrote Lady Laudine, and I'm wondering if the illustrator also changed her for you, but the illustrations in the text work so well together to just show her extraordinary frustration and upset at the situation she finds herself in.
Can say to the listeners that the situation basically is she is being asked to marry the man who killed her husband.
Exactly, right. And she sort of finds herself in a position where she sort of can't say no, but she doesn't want to marry him. She hates him. She will hate him forever. She tells him that, and yet he's like, okay, I'm fine with that.
So, right.
Talk about developing her character, you know, to the extent that you felt like you had the license to develop her further than the original work.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's so interesting about this is that Chrétien gives her these soliloquies so that we have a chance to see actually her inner thoughts. And once again, that is really not typical for medieval epic. It tends to be very close-mouthed about the way that that women think, especially when they are thinking in ways that would upset the men around them. And so a lot of it was trying to transfer some of that kind of like very straightforward medieval soliloquy where someone is addressing a kind of invisible audience into something physical that didn't even need words. So a lot of it was, you know, the illustrator and me agreeing that there were going to be silent spaces where she was going to, where the illustrator was going to kind of project that anger and find a way to you know, reproduce it.
And she did.
No. It really is fascinating to me, the sense of this as a text that is sort of breaking its own rules. You know what I mean?
Right.
The original.
Yeah. Now, a big part of this book is the lion, and in the subtitle of the book, it's the Knight of the Lion. Yvain, or however you say his name, is the
Yvain.
He's the Knight of the Lion. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the lion, about his place in this book, but also the symbolism of the lion in literature, if that's something that you care to speak about at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, so, you know, he befriends this lion, and you know, the lion goes around with him and gets him out of various scrapes and that kind of thing.
Right.
And I mean, on the one hand, it's sort of interesting because, you know, it's a very, the commentators who talk about the poem talk about it as being interesting in that it has a lot of very doctrinaire elements to it. You know, so this, people see the lion probably, okay, is it a symbol for Christ, for example, who, as this man tries to repent, this sort of protector appears at his side, the protector king of the forest appears at his side and helps him, which is, that's sort of the way that you would read a sort of a straightforward medieval epic. But once again, then you have the interesting problem that Chrétien pokes fun at the whole thing by having this character, this knight, screw up once again. He's always screwing up. Like, he's always an idiot. And so even when he tries to save people, he's doing so in a way that is sort of like selfish and entirely about his own reputation. So it's kind of cool that in a way it uses all the machinery of the epic. But once again, to this end of showing that this guy is kind of adult.
Yeah. Yeah, it almost makes
the whole idea of adventure, in a sense, is, you know, it's sort of like doltish. I mean, just the idea that you, instead of administering the sort of the lands that you have and sort of trying to produce prosperity where you live and protect the people there around you, you would go off and just kind of like smash things randomly because it's fun.
Right.
So that comes out as sort of like the difference between the world of men and the world of women. The women being the ones who have to kind of stay home and cope with administrative realities, whereas the men are supposed to be going around and showing off in these kind of semi-athletic, battle situations.
It makes you wonder if Cervantes was sort of riffing off of this particular author's work when he wrote Don Quixote, you know?
Yeah, well, like, there's such a strong feeling of similarity between them in some ways.
That's interesting. In your author's note at the end of the book, you mentioned having visited Broceliande. I don't know how to say that.
So the magical forest that appears in all these Arthurian stories, Broceliande does in fact exist. It is supposedly the forest of Pimpon in Brittany, in France. So yeah, I went there to check it out. And this particular story centers around a magical fountain where if you take water from the fountain and pour it on a particular stone, it causes this huge storm.
Yeah.
And that stone, it turns out, really exists. So I went to, it's now a site of sort of like New Age pilgrimage.
Yeah.
But I went to check it out, and it's so weird. Like, there are legal records that state that the lord of the local manor has the right not only to the land on which that fountain springs up, but also has the legal right to cause rain at any time he wants based on that fountain. The last time it was used to try to cause rain was during a drought in the 1950s.
Okay.
So,
touristy place now, or is it still very quiet?
It's not touristy. It's in the woods.
Okay.
But I mean, when I was there, for example, there were some new agey couple sitting there, like, you know, playing drums and flute and that kind of thing. So, I mean, people know it's there. It's not like you can find it if you buy guidebooks to, so that whole area is very, sort of legend haunted.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of sort of people who go there for holidays where they check out, you know, sort of like all of these forested sites where Merlin supposedly was imprisoned by Nemeux, and where Morgan Le Fay supposedly lived in these wild rocky hillsides where there are all these stones in these bizarre shapes, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a neat destination for that point of view. So people do go there for that, but it's not like, you know, it's not as if there's a gate around the whole thing.
Right, and there's no gift shop.
And they're selling churros next door or right. something. Yeah.
All right. So tell the story. I interrupted you, but I'm hoping you'll tell the story about the stone and your experience with the stone.
Oh, yeah. So there was this couple there. But I, nonetheless, you know, being a man, plunged right in, took some water from the thing and poured it on the magical stone. And like 3 minutes later, it started to downpour. So I actually felt guilty because there they were just enjoying their afternoon. And suddenly there I was wetting their drum, you know.
That's so, very funny.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that it rained. You must have been really psyched that it rained.
I was really happy. Yeah. Yeah. There was people who pointed out it's a reasonably rainy part of the country. So, you know,
yeah.
Who knows?
You want to time it right. You have to check your app before you pour your
right.
water.
Right.
All right. So I wanted to know if you, clearly you traveled. Did you do other research other than just knowing about this to begin with and maybe rereading it?
Well, I mean, I tried my best to translate it from the original, which turned out to be pretty impossible for me because it turned out like, you know, slightly later French, I can actually read okay because my French is so crappy
yeah.
that the fact that everything is spelled wrong is not a barrier for me. You know what I mean? You know, in the way that Middle English, yeah, throw in a few extra Y's and E's and, you know, just say it out loud. It all makes sense.
Right.
But what I found was that Chrétien's French I found pretty impenetrable, and so I ended up using a facing page translation from old French to modern French. So one of the interesting things was that actually did allow me to see that far from being sort of flowery as we would think that the language or something of that age would be,
yeah.
it's actually much more compact. Than the modern translations.
Interesting.
Because, you know, you're dealing with very short lines that have to be rhymed.
Right.
So everything is just, you know, like, you know, the way that the French can stow everything in their pronouns, you know what I mean? They just throw in a couple of, you know,
right.
of its.
Yep.
And, you know, yeah, I don't know, you know, as well as what they do with consonants. So, that was sort of the main thing I did. You know, it's so much easier in some ways for a writer in these situations than the illustrator, because the illustrator has to worry about all of these freaking visual details that are not mentioned in the text.
Right.
You know, I can just say armor, and she has to know what armor might look like. She has to make decisions. Oh, am I going to be historically accurate to the 12th century? Because the 12th century is not the same as the 13th century,
right,
and it's not the same as the 10th.
Right. Am I working in brown or gray?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. And so, you know, all of those details that she has to worry about, which I don't. So it makes it very easy to be a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, when you so this was the first graphic novel for both you and Andrea Offerman, who was your illustrator. And I'm wondering, how difficult did you find it writing a graphic novel? And were there rules that you had to learn or anything like that?
I read a lot of graphic novels, so it wasn't very difficult for me to kind of make that transition, especially because this material is so action oriented.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like it's about personality, but that personality arises out of action. There's not a lot of like staring out of windows.
Yeah.
Although actually, come to think of it, some people actually literally do stare out a window.
But he's looking to see something specific when he's staring.
Right, exactly, right, yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you about the style of this narrative. And I think you really kind of stayed very close to Chrétien de Troyes' interpretation of this story. But I wanted to ask you, so for example, in one of the subplots of the book, two sisters go to the courts to settle
settle a land dispute. And without getting too specific, the outcome settles things. But there's not this like American-style retribution for the sister who was in the wrong. And there is a sister who's sort of clearly in the wrong. So I just wondered, like, were you ever tempted to kind of change anything to kind of offer a more sort of like up-to-date American-style you know, even the ending of the book, there's a little bit of like, I'm like, Disney would change this for the movie.
Well, sure as hell, yeah. But then again, I'm not sure Disney would you know, make a movie in which the horse is chopped in half by a portcullis, you know? I mean, although I guess then both halves could sing, you know, together.
There you like, go.
Once I was a whole horse.
No, I think we're back to Monty Python now.
Okay. There wasn't, I mean, I guess what I liked about it is, I mean, for example, with the ending, was the fact that it feels so powerfully unresolved in modern terms,
right.
That, you know, it feels, and to me, that actually represents the kind of, the barbarity of the way that that society was ordered in a way that I think is really fascinating and important.
Yeah.
Especially because so many of us lead lives where we feel that we are living lies of one kind or another, or that we are living in a situation which is untenable to us, and yet we go on with it. You know what I mean? And I don't mean that in a melodramatic way, but I mean, think about all the people you know who say, because that's what this is about, whose marriage is sour, and yet go on for one reason or another, in that marriage, both people boiling away. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that kind of thing. It's a fact of human life that many people live in ways that are profoundly unuseful and unpleasant to them. You know what I mean?
Right. Well,
and we.
Yeah, and even just looking at the idea of story ending, you know, like that's actually a sort of like artificial construct that a story ends. I liked, I think it was Sam Shepard who said that, you know, the best story endings are sort of new beginnings, or, you know, they indicate that things are going to keep going. This is just a chapter. It's really not a whole story, right? So.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, incidentally, Chrétien wrote another epic, which is supposedly going on at the same time as this one.
Yeah.
Which is about, it's the first telling of the Lancelot Guinevere story.
Oh, okay.
So, for example, in this one where he has King Arthur say something like, oh yeah, Guinevere's not here right now. She's hanging out with Lancelot. The two of them have become so close recently. That is actually an inside joke for another poem of his, which is the one that introduced the, to our knowledge, introduced the Lancelot Guinevere thing to the world.
Camelot.
So, right, exactly, yeah.
Right.
So, but as far as changing stuff, I mean, the two sisters are interesting because I did push slightly more there on the side that, you know, the whole idea of trial by combat, you know, deciding a...
Oh, right, I didn't even mention that. That's right.
Yeah, well, which is tied into the sisters. So their cause, the two sisters, one of whom is clearly right and one of whom is clearly wrong.
Right.
Their cause is judicially decided by having two men, you know, beat each other with swords. It's a, you know, a fundamentally stupid way of conducting, you know, jurisprudence. But also it's, you know, it's, I think that the thing that I wanted to bring out was the way that, that nonetheless, in a situation like that, the men in the story are still making the story about them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So suddenly these two guys are fighting, and it's more about their relationship and whether they will prove themselves to be honorable in this relationship than it is about these two women whose fortunes and lives are on the line.
Right.
And I mean, I feel like there still are so many ways that you see that kind of thing playing out right now. I mean, it's not simply medieval. It's very deep in the structure of our society.
Yeah. And there's also Game of Thrones, but
right.
No, I'm joking. Sorry. So what's an example of how you're seeing that playing out right now?
Well, I mean, obvious things like male legislators who seem to believe that their own fights over women's issues are about their career as opposed to anything which actually affects a woman.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's as if they think, those photographs they think that come across with all the men in the room making decisions about women's health care. Yes, absolutely.
Right. It's as if so much in our political world today seems terrifyingly as if the politicians involved believe that they're fighting over like chits, mm-hmm. like just colored tokens of one kind or another. You know what I mean? Like but at the same time, what they're actually fighting over is, will certain sectors of the population be able to get what they need? Will they be able to, you know, will their lives be in danger? That kind of thing. You know what I mean? And
absolutely.
It's being played as if it's a story about politicians, but it's actually a story about citizens.
Yes. Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, I think that we can live in our own little bubbles and think, oh, they really do have our best interests at heart, at least the ones that we like. But, you know, then you see something like, this is going way, way back, but when George Bush the first didn't know about scanning things in the supermarket, and you're like, oh my gosh, they are so out of touch with what it is to be a human being.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Okay. So I'm gonna just throw a little more praise toward your illustrator. I did love the art in this book, and I loved in her notes she mentions that she tried to imitate the rhythm and repetition of the original ballad by picking up certain rhythmic elements in the placement of the panels on the page. I just felt like you picked the right person to do this.
I should say that the head of design at Candlewick, who picked Andrea, I can't take credit for it, but I think Andrea did a beautiful job, because the thing is, she does battles well, which is for this story is actually important. But the amazing thing is that also she does care so deeply about the look of these characters and the way that they interact and the design from page to page. I mean, I loved the times when she did things like just burst open the panel format. You know what I mean? And just there was, I don't know, I really admired what she did with it. I really, really loved what she did.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's talk a tiny bit about the role that obstacles place in story in general, but it particularly in adventure stories. And you talked about how Yvain is sort of stupid and makes all these terrible mistakes. But a lot of times what's happening is that there are obstacles in his path that keep him from realizing his goals. And that, I think, just is a really interesting conversation as far as story goes. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, but I think that it's also the interior and the exterior connect here.
Right.
Because, yes, there are these obstacles that are thrown in his way. It is, in many ways, like a lot of medieval literature and, frankly, like a lot of contemporary adventure literature of one kind or another, it's very episodic.
Right.
I mean, here's a giant, here's some demons, that kind of thing.
Right.
But on the other hand, what takes that from being merely an external question of, are you strong enough to defeat an enemy, into something which has more interest to me in penetration, is the question of which of these challenges does he actually need to undertake, and which of them does he undertake just to show off?
Yeah.
Because part of the whole story is that he undertakes an adventure, as so many people in this book do, merely to he essentially causes a massive hurricane to tear apart a small town,
right,
just so that he can summon force someone and start a fight with them.
Right.
You know, and so I think that is where you have the combination of the internal and the external. Sure, there are a lot of adventures, but the question is not simply what are the external barriers, but also what are the internal obstacles that he creates for himself.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, which is so true for all of us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's this one point where he promises to be back by a certain point, and it's the most important thing in his life. I mean, it's the most important thing to him, too. And yet,
right,
he kind of spaces on the timeline. It's like, seriously?
Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about who is the audience for this book?
Well, I mean, it's published for teens, but obviously it's not, I mean, there's nothing in it that I changed or in any way altered to make it for that audience.
Right.
You know, and that's been true for a lot of my books. I would say a good half of them are actually books that are for anyone, but they simply were published for teens. My feeling was very strong that as a teenager, I myself wanted more complex material, but could not in some cases find it in the, you know, the YA world when I was a teen. And so, you know, I started to read books for adults at age 12 or 13 or something. So as a writer now, what I want to kind of do is create stories that are complex enough so that adults would be entertained by them and drawn into them, and but at the same time have them be things that are actually published for teens to say to them, look, no, this is, you know, this is for you. I feel like it's so important with something like this where I'm advocating for the work of a dead author in some ways, you know, because this project is less sort of, it's not just Andrea and me, it's sort of the three of us, Chrétien, Andrea and me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, here I kind of feel like what I'm trying to do is what I think is so important in general, to say to kids, the whole history of the world is yours to inherit. You know, that's one of the things that you get with being human, is that the whole history of our species is there in the past waiting to fascinate you and to show you why things are the way that they are.
Oh, that's great.
Come and explore that. And that is something that I wish we could have for every kid. I mean, it's true in a sense, in an abstract sense, but of course, you know, access to education and everything else changes the way that people end up feeling about that inheritance. You know what I mean? And so how is it that you can actually get everyone to realize that, you know, the sciences, the humanities, all these things are the inheritance of every human and should be opened through education to them?
Yeah, that's a great answer beyond just who's going to read the book, but why it's important for them to read it too. All right, I have a quick question about another book. You wrote a book, I think it came out just maybe a year and a half ago, Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. And you recently joined the Craftsbury Chamber Players in a preseason concert that sort of like put the music together with the book. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit about that event. The book, I should mention, was longlisted for the National Book Award, which is also an award that you've won for something else. But so anyway, can you talk a little bit about this event and if you think maybe there might be others like it?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the idea is that book is actually a nonfiction book about a Russian composer during World War II, and he's in the midst of the siege of Leningrad, and so this is the story of the symphony he wrote while he was in Leningrad, which is under siege. He wrote, you know, most of it there, and it was then sort of smuggled out on microfilm through the Middle East to the United States, and it was given a performance here to try to drum up interest in the Russian cause and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the concert that I just did with the Craftsbury Chamber Players was to highlight composers who were from Shostakovich's generation, but who were crushed by Stalin's regime, and so whose voices have not been heard really for a century or so. And the idea was that I came up with a list of music that was not generally heard. I mean, you know, there are specialists who play this music, but it's not quite literally the Soviet Union. You know, they clamped down on not just composers, but also even more ferociously on authors, on visual artists, that kind of thing.
Right.
So these are composers whose names are no longer spoken in the halls of the conservatories there. And yet, if you'd read an article from the 1920s or the 1930s saying who are going to be the great composers of Russia in this new era, these are the names that would have come up. So they went from a position of being sort of, you know, there was global interest in them as the next big thing, to being exiled into the remoter regions of the USSR, where they are just transcribing folk tunes, hoping to stay alive. Mm-hmm. Because if they do much more than that, then the government will find them and crack down on them. So that was the idea. And then we did it paired with readings by, for example, the poet Anna Akhmatova, and from pamphlets of the time, that kind of thing, from Mayakovsky, stuff that was pretty directly related to the music that was being played. Yeah. And I've done a bunch of concerts like this, where I combine music with text. I'm a huge music aficionado, classical music aficionado, and so I love this idea of creating programs that kind of, you know, that frame pieces of music in relevant text that kind of brings their period alive in a different way.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it sounds like such a great event. So I hope.
Thank you. Yeah, we had a great time.
Yeah, I hope if you do another one, it's well advertised, so that I can see it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to know what you might be working on now, Tobin.
Okay, well, coming out in the fall is going to be a novel called Landscape with Invisible Hand.
Okay.
And it is a return to my sort of like science fiction roots. It's a satirical science fiction novel about a guy who is a landscape painter, but he is in particular a landscape painter trying to paint the American landscape after a colonization by aliens.
Okay.
And so the story is told entirely through descriptions of his paintings.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I mean, to me, it's also a parable about the question of colonization and identity and how you define yourself and your culture when you are not supposed to be the one speaking for your culture.
Yeah. Interesting. And so how are you doing that with the descriptions? Is that in verse or are you?
No. It's in prose. It's sort of like him talking about each picture and the way that it was generated and what's in it and that kind of thing.
Does he tell stories as he goes?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so so you get a full, I mean, it's a novel, so you do get a full arc. But, you know, it's, I just feel like it's...
That sounds just really interesting structurally. I just think that sounds cool.
Oh, well, thank you.
Are you going to have illustrations in it?
No, because we actually talked about that and decided, no, you know, in a way, because the book is a set of descriptions of illustrations,
right,
to have them appear would actually undercut that.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, that's very cool.
So you could think of it as like a catalog raisonné for a show that doesn't exist.
Okay, that sounds great. So, and that comes out in the fall?
Yes, that comes out in September, yeah.
And who's publishing that one?
Candlewick Press is publishing that as well.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. I wanted to ask if you've read any books lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Well, I mean, sure. If I can go on the dorky end, which clearly even at the beginning of this conversation I plunged into, I'm just reading the landmark Herodotus, so the Herodotus's histories and those big editions that came out when, like 10 years ago now or so?
Okay.
Which have like all these maps and everything so that you could actually follow the details more than, and the neat thing about these, about Herodotus is just that it contains every kind of story within it. You know, there are heist scenes, there's political stuff, sure, about the ancient world, but a lot of it is this crazy sort of anecdotal stuff that is full of complex relationships, and you know, beyond the fact that there are all the sort of the griffins and flying serpents you could want, and it's the descriptions of sort of almost quasi ethnographic descriptions of different nations.
Oh, cool.
So his attempt to understand the Egyptians, for example, he visits there and he's trying to explain the way that they're different from the Greeks. So there's that kind of thing too, which is totally fascinating, but it's also couched in these very dramatic stories of all of the kings whose names have become legendary to us now.
Right.
Here is someone trying to describe their careers in a historical context, and yet he himself is sort of producing an idea of history at the same time. We take our word history from him calling this book The Histories.
Okay, interesting. So now, is this book that you're reading, it's a translation, and is it all at all modernized, or is it pretty much just the original work?
It's just Herodotus.
It is.
I mean, it's translated.
Okay, but, you're just okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if this was some sort of new take on it.
No. What happened was they came out with these big sort of doorstopper landmark editions that have a lot of illustrative material in it, which actually helps because if you're dealing with something like battle lines or whatever, I'm a big military history buff.
Right.
It's interesting to actually see how these things all relate to one another, and all these names like the Ionian versus Attic and all that kind of thing. What does that mean in a map? And suddenly when you see it in a map, you realize, oh, wait, what they're describing is a cultural shift in, over 400 or 500 miles, that kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, to me, it's completely fascinating because it shows this sort of lost period of history from the point of view of someone who was, a deeply inquiring mind traveling around trying to find out about these things.
Yeah, that sounds great. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so I just have one last question for you.
I
wonder if you have any advice for authors who want to write for young adults. It's interesting. You said a little bit earlier that you don't tend to do very much differently to write for young adults. It's just that's how certain books that you write end up being marketed. But is there anything really that you would suggest to people who want to write for young adults? Maybe they've already written for another audience.
No, I mean, it's complicated because, the quote young adult genre contains all the genres within it.
Right.
You know what I mean? So,
right.
I mean, we have our own branch of, romance writing, of realistic literary fiction, of, science fiction. All these things are sort of squashed into this one category.
Right.
So there's no real way that you can, synthesize something out of that to say, oh, there's one difference.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you thinking as you're working of your reader at all, or are you just thinking about the story that you're writing?
It depends on the story.
Okay.
I wrote these two books, Octavia and Nothing.
Yes.
And those were books, they are couched in 18th century prose. They are kind of like gothic novels set during the Revolutionary War. So about a kid who discovers that he is the product of an insane Enlightenment experiment.
Right. Is that's the book that won the National Book Award?
Yes.
Yes.
The first volume. Yeah, yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Gotcha.
So those were books where in order for me to do the kind of the weird trick of trying to make it seem like a text written back in the Revolutionary period, I really was thinking about the story and the character more than the reader.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas for other things, I actually am picturing very specific readers. Like, some of my books for younger kids, I used to picture my cousins who were of an appropriate age and sort of think about them, what story would make them laugh, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So it really depends on the project.
Sure.
And the, yeah.
All right, great. So I just want to just mention again that the book is Evane, The Night of the Lion by M.T. Anderson, illustrated by Andrea Offerman, and it's published by Candlewick Press. Tobin, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
No, thanks for having me.
You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. and soon broadcasting on your radio at 99.3 FM. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with Vermont author M.T. Anderson. His new graphic novel, Evane, The Night of the Lion, came out this spring from Candlewick Press. The book draws on Arthurian lore with captivating art by Andrea Offerman. You can read more about his work at mtanderson.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to reimagine a legend, be it Arthurian, Shakespearean, Tolkien, or J.K. Rowleyan. Read part or all of a legend and write a poem, a scene, or a story inspired by your experience of what you have read. You don't have to stick to the story or even reflect it subtly. Just let it inspire you. See where it might lead to read an old tale. I will provide links to a number of possibilities on the podcast site to help you get started. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org. That's every Monday at 3. And usually, not today, but usually a second hour features a second interview. Often it's a rerun. Sometimes it's new content. Stream the show live. And when we're broadcasting, it'll be on 99.3 FM, and we will be sure to let you know. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. Truly, I'm going to just repeat that. If you like the show, you do a great favor by going to iTunes, Facebook, writing a review, giving it whatever number of stars you feel it deserves. That's really helpful. Thanks. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I hope you have a great week.